they've dumbed down political argument and opinion in America to it being all that Bush has to do is state his faith in God.
We stand here and talk about the horrors of these chemicals, many of which were made possible by the actions of our own government.
It's being sold to us as part of fighting the war on terror, but it's a great three-card Monty job.
Here in Washington, D.C., on behalf of the citizens across the nation, I ask, who called President Bush and asked him for this war?
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, January 30th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraq has invited Chief UN Weapons Inspectors Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Bardeh to return to Baghdad for more talks before their next report to the UN Security Council on February 14th. A presidential advisor suggested the talks be aimed at boosting cooperation and transparency and jointly discussing methods of disarmament verification. President Bush, meanwhile, said today he will give diplomacy weeks, not months, and said the United States would welcome Saddam Hussein going into exile. From Capitol Hill to public appearances elsewhere in Washington, key Bush administration figures kept up the war of words against the Iraqi leader. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage addressed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today, providing them with a description of allies backing the president's war.
I'm going to give you a numerical idea. I do not desire to announce the names publicly, sir, but for instance, those who have committed to full access, 21 countries are fully committed to grant us access en route. There are others that are under discussion, but we've got 20 countries that are fully committed and three that are partially committed to allow basing. We've got a total of 9 countries who have either fully committed or partially committed some troops.
Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage addressing the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Democrat Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut raised concerns about the techniques the Bush administration has employed, specifically its failure to provide evidence of Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons cache.
I'm just tired of having to hear sort of these speeches being given about this, but my people want to know why we're going to do this, other than sort of speeches given that are sort of pep rally stuff. I want to know specifically and factually what we know. And I think my constituents do, and I know my colleagues do. And before you go and tell the whole world about it, I think we have a right to know what's going on here. And that's really what the bottom of a lot of these questions are. We want to know. And that's not a partisan comment. Let me go back to this question that Senator Sarbanes raised and about the inspectors. I and Senator Hagel raised it as well. I'm sort of wondering why we supported even the resolution in October if you feel as though the inspection process is such a failure or just isn't producing results at all. It was only 60 days ago we did this. This wasn't a year and a half or 12 years ago. The Security Council of the United Nations endorsed this resolution, which a major part of which includes the inspections process. 60 days later, we're denouncing it. And by anyone's estimation, in fact, Resolution 1441 requires that every country share information with the inspectors. Not true? That there's a requirement you step up. If there are this many inspection sites and so forth, we provided about this much information as a government in terms of our obligation to meeting the requirements of 1441 to assist the inspection process. A very small fraction of the sites that we know are available, we've actually provided information about. Why are we not doing a better job of that? And if that's the case, why are we denouncing the inspection process before it's had a chance to work?
The relationship between Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld and Saddam Hussein came under congressional scrutiny when Senator Barbara Boxer of California raised concerns about the role Rumsfeld played in protecting Hussein from condemnation in the 80s.
I think the case is made. Saddam must disarm. There is no disagreement. And as I go around my state, absolutely no disagreement. He must disarm. The question is, what's the best way to do it for the world? And some of us believe, because we know it's a fact, that since more weapons of mass destruction were destroyed by the inspectors in the 90s than by our bombs, this is an approach that ought to be given every opportunity to work. Now, I want to put into the record something very unpleasant about our policies in the past. The fact is, we all know that Saddam Hussein has been committing human rights abuses since he formally took control of Iraq in 79, and even before that. He effectively took control of the country in the 60s. This man has been around. He has shown how ruthless he is. Here's the point. During the 80s, we knew human rights abuses were being carried out. We knew that Saddam was using weapons against his own people. And I think it's very important to face that fact and let the American people know, because it's important to understand how we got these weapons, why he's such a threat. And it's important not only as we make our policy here, but also as a signal to all of us that the enemy of my enemy is my friend sounds real good. But in practice, it can come back and bite us pretty hard. So I ask unanimous consent to place into the record an article called U.S. Had Key Role in Iraq Buildup, Trade in Chemical Arms Allowed Despite Their Use on Iranians and Kurds. And it was in the Washington Post, December 30th, 2002. I want to read a couple of things. The administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush authorized the sale to Iraq of numerous items that had both military and civilian application, including poisonous chemicals and deadly biological viruses such as anthrax and bubonic plague. The directive stated the U.S. would do, quote, whatever was necessary and legal to prevent Iraq from losing the war with Iran. Rumsfeld was appointed as a special envoy to the Middle East in 1983. And it quotes, when Rumsfeld finally met with Hussein on December 20th, 1983, told the Iraqi leader that Washington was ready for a resumption of full diplomatic relations, according to a State Department report of the conversation. Iraqi leaders later described themselves as extremely pleased with the Rumsfeld visit, which had, quote, elevated U.S.-Iraqi relations to a new level. As part of its opening to Baghdad, the Reagan administration removed Iraq from the State Department terrorism list in February 82, despite heated objections from Congress. When United Nations weapons inspectors were allowed into Iraq after the 91 Gulf War, they compiled long lists of chemicals, missile components, and computers from American suppliers, which were being used for military purposes. A 94 investigation by the Senate Banking Committee turned up dozens of biological agents shipped to Iraq during the mid-80s under license from the Commerce Department, including various strains of anthrax, subsequently identified by the Pentagon as a key component of the Iraqi biological warfare program. The Commerce Department also approved the export of insecticides to Iraq, despite widespread suspicions that they were being used for chemical warfare. I get chills at what we did, and the monster that was made even more of a monster because of our actions. And I think there has to be a lesson here that we have to understand and be responsible for our own actions. And we stand here and talk about the horrors of these chemicals, many of which were made possible by the actions of our own government when, for whatever reason, suddenly Saddam Hussein wasn't all that bad 20 years ago.
U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer of California during hearings today in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. One U.S. ally, Canada, objected to any unilateral action by the United States, while France and Germany have maintained that any decision to attack Iraq should be decided by the U.N. Security Council and have vowed to block a council vote if more evidence is not provided. NATO officials again sided with France and Germany, refusing a U.S. request for help in the event of war, and Russia maintains there is no grounds for military force. As the United Nations Security Council met earlier this week to hear Hans Blix's report back on the progress of the weapons inspections, voices of protest could be heard both out on the street and within the UN itself. Among those voicing concerns was the non-aligned movement of nations led by South Africa's Dumisani Khumalo, the South African ambassador to the United Nations.
The non-aligned movement does not believe in war. In fact, the United Nations was founded as an organization of peace. What we would like to do is allow first the inspectors to do their work. If the inspectors come back to the Security Council and say, we're giving up, it's not working, we're obstructed all the way, the resolution requires the Security Council to then take a decision. But what we are saying is that 60 days, and it's only been less than a month since I've had 12 helicopters. So they are now beginning to go around the country. This is not the time to then start and saying, you've done enough, we're going to move away. So we're saying, allow the process and then make the decision.
South Africa's Ambassador Dumisani Khumalo speaking at the United Nations earlier this week. Former South African President Nelson Mandela said today the United States was preparing for war because, quote, George Bush wants to get hold of the Iraqi oil, end quote. Bush met with Italian Premier Silvio Berlusconi today, a firm supporter of the United States' hardline position toward Iraq. In an Oval Office session with the Italian leader, Bush put allies on notice that he will not wait long to act against Saddam Hussein, even if the United Nations refuses to back his actions. And while British Prime Minister Tony Blair is closely aligning his government with the United States in its plans to launch a war against Iraq, retired British parliamentarian Tony Benn is en route to Baghdad for a personal meeting and interview with Saddam Hussein. The last time Benn met with Hussein, he achieved the release of British hostages. He spoke with WBAI's Bernard White and Robert Knight this morning on Pacifica Station WBAI's Wake Up Call.
I'm going to Baghdad Friday, and Saddam Hussein has indicated that he will give me an interview, which will be televised, and I'll bring the film back. And the reason I'm going is because I want to explore the possibilities for peace at a time when President Bush and Mr. Blair seem intent upon a war, whether they get the support of the Security Council or not.
Do you have any insight as to what your nominal leader, Tony Blair, might be doing at Camp David this weekend with President Bush?
Well, I can only go by what I have no inside knowledge, but it would appear that following the State of the Union message, the strategy which Prime Minister Blair is going along with is that they'll meet in Camp David, they will agree the war plans. I think Colin Powell is making a statement to the Security Council on the 5th, producing evidence, and then the inspectors may be given another week because American forces are not ready, and then after that the war will begin. That's the timetable that I see it. If it's done without the Security Council, and it may be the French or the Russians or the Chinese veto it, but if it is done without the Security Council, it will of course be a war of aggression. It will involve tearing up the charter. A lot of innocent people, many of whom dislike Saddam Hussein, will be killed. The Middle East could go up in flames, and the long-term damage to the relations between Christians, Muslims, and Jews could be very serious indeed.
What are the parameters? What is the range of what he might say that could alter the playing field? What are you anticipating?
Well, I'm not going to anticipate the questions, and I'm not going to comment on what he said until the broadcast takes place, which I hope will be on Tuesday or Wednesday, probably Wednesday, the day that Colin Powell makes his statement. I saw him in 1990 and had 3 hours with him, and I asked him to release the British hostages, which he did, and I think a lot of things have come out. For example, it'd be interesting to know about his talks with Donald Rumsfeld in 1981 when the United States was supplying the ingredients for chemical weapons.
I'm wondering just how this has played among the people in the land.
Well, I don't think the Prime Minister has got much support in Britain. I've never known a time since the Suez Crisis in 1956 in any way comparable to this. There's mass opposition nationally. I mean, an overwhelming majority against the war. In the House of Commons, there are very large numbers of people who are doubtful. I can't tell you the exact number, but the main consideration for many of them would be whether the Security Council authorized an attack, which I don't think they will, and Parliament has never been consulted. I mean, President Bush had to go to the Congress to get authority for war, but under the British Constitution, the Prime Minister can do what he likes. So, one of the major tabloids is absolutely against it, and the media have had to give some attention to it because it is such a large body of opinion.
It's my understanding that over the weekend, I believe you have the YouGov poll, which indicated that only 1 in 5 people in the United Kingdom would support non-United Nations sanctioned war of conquest in Iraq.
It's about oil. Everybody knows it's about oil.
Are there countervailing forces, if only of electoral self-preservation within the Labour Party that could be...
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mentioned Suez. I was in Parliament at the time of Suez in 1956 and even went to war with Egypt. And thank God President Eisenhower, a Republican president, intervened to stop the war. And Eden lost his job and was replaced by Harold Macmillan as Prime Minister. I think the Prime Minister could lose his job on this. I'm not interested in that, but I'm interested in peace. But even a government in a democratic country cannot disregard public opinion. I suppose the Prime Minister hopes there'll be a victory very, very rapidly. Saddam will be killed, and the oil will be handed over to the American companies, and General Tommy Franks will be put in charge as the American dictator of Iraq, and the Prime Minister will say, well, there we are, we solved the problem. I suppose that's what he's hoping, but I'm afraid it isn't going to be as easy as that. And the fact that innocent people will be killed will be seen as a major consideration.
British parliamentarian Tony Benn speaking this morning on WBAI's Wake Up Call with Bernard White and Robert Knight. During the State of the Union, President Bush failed to mention any programs for developing affordable housing and a number of social issues facing our nation. Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles opened the phone lines for listeners to share their feelings of the State of the Union.
State of the Union. Unemployment is up. States are drowning in record deficits. Social services being cut left and right. Try and go to one of the general hospitals. Try and sit there for about 2 days for, you know, if you need stitches. We know Bush and all his buddies are doing fine and dandy, but what's your take? What are you thinking about? What are you thinking are the issues that need to be covered? From Glendale on line one. Martin, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
Good, good.
Listen, I have a couple of remarks direct from the Fuhrer's mouth, which nobody seems to have heard but me. Late last year, he said that in order to fund this tax give back to the rich people, one of the means he was going to get the money was he was going to take away half of the Social Security raise, the cost of living raise, and he kept that promise. When he threatens something, he keeps his promise, and that is exactly what he did. And nobody, where was AARP when this happened? And no one talks about that at all. Are you familiar with that?
It seems vaguely familiar. I wasn't that familiar with it, though. But, it's interesting because what you're saying, it's such an outrage. And then you think about it, and here he is trying to, go off on this tip. Like, he's all for people that are, on Social Security. He's all for that. He's going to help with Medicare. It's all stuff. When actually even that is a knife in the back. Martin, thanks a lot for calling. We got to move on, man. All right, let's get Gene in Valencia on line 7. Gene, how are you?
Hello, I'm doing okay. The State of the Union is facing the potential end of the world with a maniac proposing nuclear war. And nobody's talking about it.
Isn't that incredible? I mean, here they've just said this thing about, they're going to use nukes in Iraq. And who knows where that just lowering that threshold. It's incredible.
It's just frightening. Daughter's in college, and it's like, what future do these kids have? When we grew up, it was how to, stop other countries from using them. Now we're proposing to use it on a country and make sure they don't have weapons to defend themselves. It's insane.
Right, and let's
And I've said since the stolen election, he didn't steal that election for no reason. This is a war against the American people, and people better really wake up. This man is a maniac.
Yep, that's it. Anyway, all right, Gene, thanks a lot.
Letting me express myself.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, I noticed somebody, Manuel, on the 605 freeway.
How you doing?
Okay, what's up, man?
I just wanted to say that just two things quickly. Thanks a lot for opening up the line.
And you're welcome.
Definitely from the perspective of someone who's struggling and seeing firsthand how difficult it is to be sort of under a certain economic level in this country and be able to get by, sort of the discrimination on an economic level, regardless of color. And secondarily, I'd also like to mention that from a Native perspective, a Native American perspective, the kind of devastation we're seeing around the country to sacred sites, to our very religion itself, whether it's the religious right to, engage in our own Native churches, Native American church, et cetera, and having those sacred sites being bulldozed over, et cetera, sometimes in the name of science. And that, for me, is a sad state of the union.
All right, man. Thanks a lot. Next, go to Mike in Los Angeles. Mike, how are you?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now, man. What's up?
Yes.
What's your state of the union?
I heard from an interview Senator Daschle gave last week that Bush's tax cut proposes a $90,000 relief check in tax cuts for the 225,000 millionaires in this country, and then I think it's $90 for everybody else per year. So that's a real, and it's not a tax cut. It's just what it is a redistribution of who pays for the cost of government. These people disenfranchise themselves from the cost of government. These deficits later on will be shifted to those who did not get the $90,000 a year. So all this is a shifting of more of the tax burden onto the middle class and the poor. It's not a tax cut for anybody but the people that live in outer space.
And, yep, that's it. And that's what it's all about, Mike. It's about America is fighting to make the world safe for millionaires and billionaires. Let's never forget that. All right, man. All right, Jimmy, Native American from the Tongva tribe. Jimmy, how are you?
I'm doing good, thank you. How are you?
Good, good.
You know, I didn't get a chance to hear the State of the Union, but I do have a statement. I'm indigenous to Los Angeles County, Riverside County, and Orange County. I'm Tongva Indian. I'm the Native American spiritual leader for California Youth Authority. And my statement is that we need to get out of the Arab nations. What's happening there happened here 200 years ago, only instead of gold, it's oil. We need to get out.
That's it, man, exactly. And when it's an unjust war 200 years ago, it's an unjust war today. And people got to recognize that and stand up against it. We're going to move on, man. So to keep listening, and we're going to go to Ann in Pasadena. Ann, how are you?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
You got to make it quick, about 30 seconds if you got it. What's your State of the Union?
You know, every time he says, well, I see a storm coming, and every time he sees something that's negative and he puts it on something else, he should look in the mirror and see himself. And I think what we need to do is impeach the group and legislate the Supreme Court justices out of their positions because they are not capable of representing the people.
All right, and I take it a step further. I think what we need to do is overthrow them. So let's go to
that one. Yeah, whatever. We need to just get them out of there.
All right. Bye. All right, thanks a lot. All right, let's go to, how about William in Woodland Hills? William, how are you?
Hey there.
Yeah, sure, go ahead, man.
I just want to tell you, I find it so interesting that we're going after Saddam in Iraq for non-compliance, but we're willing to not be in compliance to go after Saddam for not being in compliance.
Down is up, you know.
Is that interesting?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's exactly it. Welcome to the rabbit hole, brother. Welcome to Wonderland.
That's all I wanted to make a point out.
All right. Thanks a lot, man. John from Mid-Wilshire. John, how are you? Just because you're in Mid-Wilshire, how are you?
How are you guys?
Good. How about you?
Briefly, I just want to say, I want to give two sides of the coin, the negative and the positive, as far as the state of the nation.
But you got to be quick, brother.
Where I'm sitting. It's amazing. The coup d'etat that took place was basically the intelligence community taking over, and who are they run by, who are they owned by, the oil companies. So that's the negative. The positive is I cannot believe in such a short amount of time that not just here in America, but all over the world, they're seeing right through this, and the momentum momentum is building, and I just want to give big ups to everyone who's working in the peace and justice movement, and KPFK and outlets like this, because I'm sitting in my living room watching MSNBC and CNN and all these corporate media controlled, oil company controlled media, having to cover the peace and justice movement because the movement is enormous and it's global.
All right, so I want to thank you very much.
Listeners on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, hosted and produced by Michael Slate. Today at a Boys and Girls Club in Washington, D.C., President Bush celebrated the one-year anniversary of the Freedom Corps, the national volunteering initiative he announced during last year's State of the Union. Ingrid Drake from WBIX Refugees and Exiles Radio Network reports.
In the auditorium of a Boys and Girls Club in Washington, D.C., Bush was joined by Bob Dole, John Glenn, and former Redskins football team player Daryl Green to celebrate volunteerism. President Bush addressed a large crowd of local politicians, Washington insiders, and more than 100 young people from D.C. and Baltimore. Bush highlighted his goals of expanding mentoring and faith-based initiatives and spoke about how compassion and love will solve America's domestic problems.
The goal of this country is for everyone, not just a few, everyone in every community, in every state, in every part of our country, to understand the greatness and potential of this country. Everybody counts in life. Everybody matters. Everybody is precious in the sight of the Almighty. Everybody has worth. That's what would be a philosophy that drives this government as we work to strive to make the American experience strong and hopeful for every single citizen.
While Bush brought his own applauding troops, many people in the audience were less enthusiastic. More than 100 young people who are currently volunteering for community development and environmental justice full-time attended the event. Most of these community volunteers were critical of President Bush's speech heralding volunteering because he did not address their concerns about a military invasion of Iraq.
My name is Diamond Teague.
I'm 18 years of age. I'm with the Eagle Corps. I wasn't too excited at all. I mean, especially what's going on right now.
My name is Beatrice Barrows. I'm 23. I'm from Washington, D.C. I work for AmeriCorps at the Latin American Youth Center. All I could think about was how we're going to war soon, so I wasn't really into what he was saying because it seems like he was contradicting himself the whole time, talking about love and compassion and how we have to be a better country, but yet we're about to go into a war that half of us don't even know why.
My name is Tindani Mpulabusi, 20 years old. I'm here with the Earth Conservation Corps today.
Would you be willing to serve in the armed forces or the military at this point?
No, because I study a lot of history and politics and economics, and I'm aware and I feel that I should fully agree with the cause of going to war if I would go. And I don't fully agree with it.
My name is Mikhail Mayfield. I'm 24. And I currently reside in Northwest Washington, D.C.
Can you tell me, what did you think of President Bush's speech?
I thought it was somewhat telling. I mean, because it seemed like there was a lot of love in there. You know, it was like every other word was love, this, love, that, and compassion and things of that nature. But when you listen to, like, maybe a speech about, you know, what's going on with Iraq and other things in the country, you don't get that same love and that compassion, you know. It's like more so like he wants to bully and, you know, bogart and go in there and do whatever he wants to do to fit his specific agenda. But at the same time, if that's the example that we're seeing and the only time we see all this love and compassion is at a little Boys and Girls Club event, what's going to be the greater influence? And then you wonder why, you know, the country is the way it is, because what you say and what you do are two different things, and what you do always overpowers what you say.
Fortunately for the president, there was no question-answer period. Otherwise, Bush would have had to answer to a tough crowd.
I would have asked him, where's the money going to come from for this plan that he's going to lay out?
Basically, if every single life counts here in America and abroad, and putting forth efforts to countries in Africa for AIDS and so forth, then how can we start bombing in Iraq, and what happens to those lives that we're taking away?
I would ask him, basically, why is he trying to go to war? That's basically my big concern is why. I mean, where he could just talk.
Whether or not we're going to war, if we are going to war, what the costs are going to be.
Where's the love and compassion in regards to, you know, other countries, other issues that are going on now, and not just, you know, community service in America, but, you know, where's the love and compassion with other peoples that don't happen to be Americans and don't happen to reside in the country, pay taxes in the country, and vote for the leaders of the country? An answer I would have got back, but that's what I would have asked him.
Thanks to Tom Gomez from WBIX.org, Refugees and Exiles Radio Network, and Reem Kakuda for help on this segment. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from Washington, D.C., I am Ingrid Drake.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, we'll hear about U.S. oil interests in Venezuela, and we'll hear from the British group Chumbawamba. We'll be back in a moment.